Welcome to the Independent Schools Show podcast series. Please enjoy and head to schoolsshow.co.uk for more information.
Thank you very much, and thank you to our audience who have come to hear today's talk. I'm joined by Camilla Smiley from the Good Schools Guide, who started teaching through the Teach First scheme when you left university. And now work with the Good Schools Guide, and David Quidwell, who has been at Bruin Dolphin for
23 years.
Yes, man, you don't look like you've been there for 23 years, but that's fantastic. Now you're here. I said rather facetiously at the end of the last session, you're here to tell parents how on earth they're going to pay for private school education, as it were. And obviously, I am the parent of two pupils at. Private school. So there are straightforward ways of paying in terms of planning ahead and saving, and there are also ways to access bursaries. But our previous talk, we also, it wasn't a sort of head-to-head, as it were, but we had the contrast, as it were, or the choice between going boarding and going day. Now, one of the things that parents think about, particularly when they think about boarding, is boarding costs a lot more. So, David, can I start with you? What are the real costs when you... Because actually, if you bother to do an Excel spreadsheet, the cost of feeding your child at home or being fed at school, it may turn out to be rather different.
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly in terms of the financial planning aspect, and I'm sure Camilla will come onto more detail, I think when you're looking at how to plan for savings, doing that cash flow analysis, as we would sort of professionally call it, is key. And that's building in costs such as fees, but also the hidden costs, as Camilla will cover. But also things like inflation, school fee inflation, looking at the structure of one's affairs, so looking at the impact not just of paying for school fees in isolation, but also the impact of that on the parents' own financial plans in terms of retirement planning, what post-school fee planning looks like. Do you get to the end of school fees and then you think about your own retirement, which is suddenly X number of years less away, and go from there, really? So it can be quite a considerable difference.
Camilla, do you have a view on the hidden costs, perhaps, of day school compared to the more overt costs of boarding school, or is that an unfair characterisation?
I think what quite a lot of people would be surprised by when they look at the figures, as you say, is that the gap perhaps isn't as extreme as you might think. I think the headline costs are obviously
exactly.
Very different.
And what you see is the headline.
Yeah, exactly. So what you see is this will be £40,000 a year, this will be £25,000 a year. I mean, neither of them are particularly appealing, but we know which one is more so. I think the cost, particularly in London, the cost, as you alluded to, of keeping a teenager, are quite significant. I know that after-school fees, everyone's sort of second favourite topic, is house prices. And obviously, the as soon as you're buying into an area where you've got access to brilliant local schools, then you're paying a premium for those houses. If you go boarding, perhaps you're a bit more flexible on where in London you live.
Now, that is actually a brilliant point.
I mean, I think, look at Barnes, look at Hammersmith, look at Chiswick, look at Hampstead and Highgate, down into Dulwich, where you get pockets of very, very good independent schools. You also get pockets of very, very expensive houses. The cost of keeping a teenager, obviously, you have to feed them, as you say, to fill the fridge daily. And you have to get them to school. You potentially have to pay for some childcare after school. In London, that's £15, £20 an hour straight up. Or you have to house an au pair in your already quite expensive house. So there are lots of hidden costs of day school, which I think close that gap slightly.
That is fascinating.
Okay,
great. Let's talk about financial planning with David first, because we're going to talk to Camilla later in a minute about bursaries. But you're a financial advisor. You advise individuals on how they should manage their income and so on, and savings. So without wishing to feel that the horse has bolted off the stable doors. At what age should I have started financial planning at 12 for my children's education?
Yeah, you may feel like you should have done.
Or normal people, what should they be thinking about?
I think, you know, in doing the job for as long as we do, and the breadth and variety of clients that we look after, you come across almost everybody in every conceivable circumstance. And I think in the same way that we would say it's never too early to start, and you can certainly look at the impact of starting earlier and sending a child later to fee-paying school, whether that's 8 or 11, and the benefits of that in terms of what the effect of compounding investment returns and those sorts of things bring. Equally, it's also important to say it's never too late. Just because you didn't start at 12, actually to start at, and we get plenty of clients and grandparents who are looking, saying, you know, my eldest grandchild is in year four. Is it too late to start, or how do we put together that plan? And I think, again, it comes back to that analysis and looking at the structure of someone's affairs to determine whether it's affordable in the first place. And if in utopia you can get the school you want to send your children to and it all fits with that plan, great. If it doesn't, then you work backwards, and sometimes those are difficult conversations to have, but they're important conversations to have.
And just to be crude about it, in terms of, you know, say you've got enough income, do people just stick as much money as they can in an ISA to prepare for the later school fees?
In practical terms, clearly, one of the key considerations in a planning perspective is tax efficiency. The more money that remains in your pocket by holding monies in an ISA, where returns are entirely tax-free, the better. The more money that's in HMRC's pockets, absolutely fine. They'll use it wisely, but they're not going to use it to educate your child. So I think there's a balance to be had, but certainly using tax allowances, tax-free saving schemes and so on, particularly in what we would refer to as the accumulation phase, so to build that capital up so that when you do need to start drawing on it, or you do need it for the top-ups and the, you know, the hockey tours to South Africa or whatever it may be, when your children are at private school, you've got the resources behind you.
Can I just ask one quick myth about school fees? Can you pay up front, say, for 5 years? And do schools allow that to happen? And is that a wise way to put your money in? I've always been tempted, if I was available, just so I couldn't get my grubby hands on it.
Well, I think it comes down to, probably between the two of us, you'll get the right answer. I think certainly from a planning perspective, it's something that a lot of parents are now looking at. And potentially, you know, I'm sure we'll come on to some of the aspects of things like relocation and so on. I think the frustration for many is actually that the level of discounts is much less than you would expect. So a recent example of a client was looking at a discount of 2% a year. And in one respect, as a financial planner, you're looking at that and saying, well, I can guarantee that capital will return 2% a year. But you're having conversations with clients who are willing to take some degree of risk with capital when they're investing it, and say, well, actually, look, if we can, over a 5, 6, 7 year period, if we're comfortable with volatility and that capital moving up and down, but in the long run, we know we can get more than 2% a year, especially free of tax, because we can use ISA allowances and so on, so much the better.
So, Camilla, perhaps I've unfairly put you in the bursaries box, but you may want to make other comments in terms of what David's been talking about. But obviously, one is always thinking about bursaries, and schools often like to highlight bursaries. I mean, are they a real thing? Are they a real tool for, as it were, the average middle-class family, if I can put it that way?
They are a real thing. They're increasingly a real thing, particularly in London day schools. And there are a few London day schools, so St Paul's unusually giving a threshold of about £120,000, as they'll talk to you about bursaries if you earn less than that. Latimer Upper doing really good work in this area. Dulwich, JAG, some schools doing a lot of work to increase access. And I think it comes from a very genuine place, actually, that sort of leaving this ivory tower reputation behind, I suppose, and making sure that these day schools are really stimulating, really exciting sort of microcosms of the community around them, and making sure that the best and brightest year sevens are in those schools regardless of their ability to pay. So yes, bursaries are real. I think that, well, a lot of the school's funds have been pulled away from scholarships in that regard, so it's no longer, you know, now if you're very good at sport or music or art or drama or academics, you might be looking at a 5 or 10 or 15%, 20% even scholarship. But really where the schools are investing is in means-tested bursaries. And you have to be prepared to have your finances really scrutinised. You know, I get a lot of people coming to me, you know, friends coming to me and saying, listen, we don't really feel like we can afford it, but actually it's up to the school whether or not you can afford it. And they will look at where you live, they'll look at your lifestyle, they'll look at your assets as well as your income. They may even, I know we're going to talk a little bit about grandparental support later, they may even look at potential there. So you need to be very transparent and very open about all the different elements of your finances. And yes, they are giving away a lot of money in bursary provision nowadays.
Can I just drill down into that a bit? One question I had, which occurred to me, is one is, do you simply say, take what it says on the website? You mentioned the 120 grand at St. Paul's, but for the sake of argument, you know, you could be self-employed and your income could fluctuate. Should you, even though it appears to in black and white have a cut-off, should you simply have a conversation with the school if you're worried? And actually, that was my other question. Can bursaries kick in as an emergency? So you arrive at the school and you're very happy and you're paying the school fees, no problem. Lose your job 2 years later. It's no longer simply a case of, right, I've got to take my kid out.
Absolutely. So I'll just deal with your second question very quickly first, which is that, yes, there are what are usually called hardship funds, which are effectively emergency bursaries. And schools will have different policies on this. And in fact, schools' policies will fluctuate over time, depending on how rich they're feeling, how much money they've got to distribute. Obviously, the past 18 months has been really difficult for schools in that regard. But there are emergency funds available. And sometimes it'll be, you know, perhaps your child's just started year 10, so just started a two-year GCSE course, and the school will ensure that that child is able to remain in school until they've done their GCSEs and then work with you to find a more appropriate sixth form. So it might just be to tide you over until the next good time to leave, rather than leaving you in the lurch. Yes, there is that money there. In terms of bursaries and accessing them, I think that picking up the phone and speaking to people is really important. So we would always advise clients to go to the schools themselves and speak to registrars and be very open, even before you're filling in the registration form, be very open about your circumstances and the kind of bursary that you'd be looking for if your child was offered a place. I think, you know, ticking the form ticking the box on the registration form and hoping for the best, you need to have a plan B. You don't know what these schools are going to say. So I think the more that you can speak to people, the more you can speak to registrars, I mean, today's the perfect opportunity, the better idea you can get before your child sits those exams of whether or not you could actually take up a place if it was offered.
So I want to talk to the one issue which caused me to have a flaming row with my mother when I read 90% of grandparents. I mean, my mother's fond of saying she's in the elite 10%, but I hadn't realised in this category. So is it now becoming much more common for the extended family, as it were, to some money in the pot, if I can put it that way?
I think it's a combination of reasons. And I think certainly where it comes to grandparental support, sometimes that's simply a fact of circumstance. So grandparents will be looking at the value of their estate. They have an inheritance tax problem, or they have an inheritance tax liability, and giving away money is one of the ways that you can reduce that problem. And there are various ways that can make that problem go away much faster than the textbook, which is a 7-year exemption period for gifts from capital. So quite often you'll have parents who are in this, or the parents of the parents of the child going to school, who are in the sort of, I suppose what I would bitterly say, the kind of golden generation of final salary pensions in payment, inflation-proofed and so on, who have excess income, and that excess income can be given away immediately exempt from IHT. So quite often they'll look at making those regular gifts, and those regular gifts can be utilised for school fee planning and so on. Equally, there are schemes that can use excess capital to provide a tax-efficient income, or potentially through trusts, which is possibly probably a subject for another day, given the complexity and the breadth of that. But it's becoming much more common.
But it is an interesting point that you should have potentially a conversation with close relatives, just in the way you talk to the registrar at the school, because actually grandparents or other relatives might not even occur to them that they could talk to their own financial advisor.
Yeah,
and actually find a very tax-efficient way to support their grandchildren.
Yeah,
I mean, most grandparents think it's about just writing out a cheque and it's a bit of a pain and I wish they hadn't asked, kind of thing, but actually it could be pretty tax-efficient.
Yeah, and I think equally, some, you know, you're having those conversations which can feel very awkward. If you're the parent talking to the grandparent, you can sometimes, you know, it's natural to feel that you're going with the sort of proverbial begging bowl, but actually it's part of a sensible financial plan for the grandparents. And equally, not quite, if you don't ask, you don't get. But quite often we'll have grandparents saying, you know, we're quite comfortable giving away capital. And parents at various points saying, look, you know, it's your money, we don't want it. And again, it comes back to this cash flow planning and this strategy and making sure everything's as flexible as possible, so that as circumstances change, as fee-paying school comes onto the radar, or whatever the analogy should be, that clients have the ability to do that. People have the ability to do that and to make decisions accordingly.
So is it becoming more common, and do the schools like it or not like it, for parents to pay school fees in monthly instalments rather than term by term? Is that something that's encouraged by schools, or is it... Because it would make sense in terms of managing your cash flow over the year, to pay in monthly instalments, but I don't know whether the schools like that.
I mean, it seems, just anecdotally in terms of the clients that I have, they're more often than not, it's monthly by direct debit, just purely for that cash flow, the cash flow side of it. I think going back to discounts, you know, if you're paying termly up front, you're sort of saying, well, okay, what do I get for the 3 months I'm giving you? Not a lot. What do I do for the year up front? Not a lot. What do I do for the whole gamut? Not a lot. So I think that's more circumstantial of where we are with things like interest rates and so on. So I think more importantly, the school probably have it for the cash flow purposes and that's that. But I guess it helps everyone.
Brilliant. We've got a small but perfectly formed audience. I just wondered whether anyone wanted to raise, whether I've missed any burning point that was agitating. But otherwise, I can say that Camilla and David, you're going to be here till about midnight.
Absolutely.
Available. You'll just be sitting in a corner outside waiting for people to come and ask you questions.
Yeah.
And to give them free advice.
Yeah. Waiting for a phone call from my mum, actually, I think, to,
Yeah, exactly.
She's going to chip in after all.
Yeah, quite right. So, look, David, Camilla, thank you so much for coming. It's been very instructional. And you will be available after this event for a bit of time if people bump into you outside and want to ask a burning question.
Absolutely.
So thank you very much.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed that episode. Thanks for listening, and please head to schoolsshow.co.uk to check out our other recordings.